And it's 062578, and it's Trujillo versus Snyder. And it's Mr. Baker.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Mr. Baker.
My name is James Baker. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of Tracy Trujillo. In October of 2001, Ms. Trujillo was a senior public administrator for the Illinois Department of Corrections. She was a term appointee, and at that time, the defendants elected not to renew her four-year term. Before the district court, she claimed that there was a connection between the defendant's non-renewal decision and her engagement in protected speech while she served as a procurement officer at the department. The district court granted the defendant summary judgment, and that finds us on our way to this court. For purposes of this appeal, there are two separate acts of speech which are at issue. The first occurred in the spring of 2000. Ms. Trujillo reported to the Federal Bureau of Investigation a belief of some procurement irregularities in a contract that was subsidized through federal funding. The second occurred in the fall of 2000 when Ms. Trujillo, pursuant to a section of the Illinois Procurement Code, reported, I believe, 13 separate irregularities, procurement irregularities, to both the Illinois Attorney General and the Director of the Department of Central Management Services. The district court, in going through those particular irregularities in Ms. Trujillo's report, kind of said it was a mixed bag. Some of them related to what the district court concluded were policy differences. The others, however, related to potential procurement misconduct, such as releasing confidential procurement information to bidders who were engaging in a bidding project, identifying the bid specifications so narrowly that only one bidder would be eligible, showing favoritism to particular bidders. And the court said that really involved a little more than policy differences. So that's the backdrop of the case. I would like to address an issue that the district court really didn't address, but I think it's a threshold issue in this case, and that is, how does Ms. Trujillo's speech interface with the ruling in Garcetti versus Sabala, which was decided about 2 weeks after the district court decided this case? It's our view that even in the wake of Garcetti and in view of the cases this court has decided since the Garcetti decision, that Ms. Trujillo's speech on those two instances was speech as a citizen. And having read this court's discussion of Garcetti in a variety of situations, it appears as though the cases are very fact-specific, but if we were to distill a common denominator from them, it is that in order for Garcetti to bar otherwise protected speech, there would have to be a direct tie between the employee's normal and routine duties and the nature of the speech, and the fact that the speech in some respect arose out of employment, or the fact that the speech was made through a specified channel of communication would be non-dispositive.
Okay, well then let me ask you this. The 5040 memorandum,
yes,
states that she doesn't make criminal or other accusations against anyone, and seeks formal guidance as to legal issues regarding procurement. But Isn't it part of her job description to provide legal guidance regarding procurement, and wasn't that memorandum a means of accomplishing her job?
I agree with the first point you make. I disagree with the second. If she had written this memorandum in the context of seeking advice from her counterparts at CMS, or if she had done it through a memo to Chief Legal Counsel of the Department of Corrections seeking legal advice, I would agree. In this case, she wrote that memorandum in furtherance of a state statute which required all state employees, not just Ms. Trujillo, but any state employee who suspects either collusion or anti-competitive practices to submit those concerns. And it was within that context that it was done. Had she done it in a different context, I would agree with the court. I think that the fact she chose this context, and this is the way it was done, separates this from the normal and routine parts of her job. With respect to the, and I might add here, this was not an obligation under Illinois law which was vested solely upon employees who had procurement responsibilities, but it extended to all state employees. So, for example, if a guard at the Statesville Correctional Center came upon information that there might be some favoritism shown to bidders, he would have the same obligation that she had. The FBI analysis, I think, is a bit easier. Ms. Trujillo reported what she felt were some irregularities in a contract involving a contractor named ComGuard. The only tie between that report and her state duties is that she heard a rumor about it at work. She didn't know whether it was true or not true, but felt that in order to do due diligence, she should report it to the federal authorities. The whole incident at issue with respect to ComGuard occurred well before her arrival, and she had nothing to do with that. I would like to turn briefly to the causation issues with respect to Ms. Trujillo reporting this incident to the FBI. The district court felt that even though it was protected speech, there was not enough of a connection between that incident and her ultimate non-renewal, and made a point of indicating that there wasn't anything in the record that would suggest that the defendants were aware that it was Ms. Trujillo who made the report. And I guess if we're talking about specific direct evidence, the district court is correct, because none of the defendants said, "We know you went to the FBI." Ms. Trujillo did not tell them to their face, "I went to the FBI." But I think there is circumstantial evidence which would allow a reasonable jury to infer that the defendants suspected she did. The first is that Ms. Trujillo, throughout the course of her employment in the procurement area, had been an outspoken critic about irregularities. She cried wolf a lot, and I think within that context it would be reasonable for the defendants to perceive she had something to do with it. Secondly, immediately after the FBI came into the picture, even though the incidents related to things that had occurred formerly in her work unit, and she would be a logical person to be an informational source to the federal investigators because of her job, she was removed from the loop and told to have no further involvement. Thirdly, is a comment made not by one of the defendants, but in the presence of two of the defendants, and this is a comment made by Missy Stutler, where she indicated that she thought Ms. Trujillo looked to be very chummy with the FBI agent. Now, the district court said that was an ambiguous comment, and I think it may be somewhat ambiguous, but it certainly indicates that there was some perception that there was a relationship. And I think that's a reasonable inference, and I think it's a competitive inference to the one that the court drew. But the real significance is not what Ms. Stutler said, but what Ms. Trujillo said in response, which was that she had known this particular FBI agent for many years. They had gone to school together at one time. So that evidence taken together, I think, would be enough to make a connection. In the memorandum Mr. Little prepared at the direction of his superiors to assess and evaluate Ms. Trujillo's candidacy for non-renewal of her term appointment, he alluded to her conduct in calling into question with external agencies the integrity of the department and this particular administration. All of that suggests that the defendants had some appreciation of her involvement. The defendants in their brief make a point, and that is that if one were to take a look and look alone at the time span between her protected act speech, the FBI in the spring of 2000, and the non-renewal of her term, there's not enough of a connection to draw an inference of unlawful retaliation. And I think if you look at that and that alone, that's a reasonable point. But what you have to keep in mind is that Ms. Trujillo essentially was a civil service employee during the period of time her term was in effect. And she could only be discharged for cause. And when she was discharged and protected by the civil service system, she could appeal the discharge to the Civil Service Commission. It was only after she lost that protection that she was an at-will employee. And the long and the short of it is the defendants chose to eliminate her position when they had the very first opportunity to do that. I see I'm calling in my rebuttal time, so unless the court has some questions of me, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Mr. Siegel, good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Siegel, before you start, I have a sort of an odd little question. Is there a conflict of interest in the AG representing the defendants here, since one of the letters at issue was sent to the AG's office? Has that been thought about at all?
Yes, Your Honor. I thought about it in preparing, and my supervisors, I am sure, thought about it when they logged this case in and did the conflicts check that they do. I can't talk, as you may understand, about what went on internally when Ms. Trujillo sent her memo to us. But that was 8 years ago, approximately. Had there been a criminal, had the office gone forward with a criminal investigation, it would have been in the name of the people of Illinois. And had Mr. Snyder or any of my other clients been target of an investigation or a prosecution, there would have been sufficient steps taken to ensure that there wasn't any conflict of interest. That said, when we represent state agencies in our civil capacity, we're representing those employees in their official capacities, which would be different than a criminal prosecution against the individuals. I hope that addresses your question, Judge Rovner. And good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm here with Jane Notes, Deputy Solicitor General, and we represent the defendants Donald Snyder, Walter Small, and Nicholas Little, counsel. Your Honors, the Court should affirm the District Court and can do so because of various concessions and admissions by Ms. Trujillo. They dispose of the threshold question in this case under Garcetti versus Sabalas. But apart from those admissions, Trujillo relies on conjecture to support her claim that her contact with the FBI was the cause for her departure. Neither her admissions nor conjectures are sufficient to defeat summary judgment. First, I'd like to talk a little bit about Garcetti, and next, in the alternative, if the court finds that Garcetti does not apply, there are alternative grounds to affirm. There are two types of speech here, as Mr. Baker has noted, the memo and the FBI. But neither of them is protected under Garcetti because both of them were pursuant to Trujillo's official job duties. And I'd like to jump right in and disagree with counsel's characterization, particularly in his reply brief, of how the case law has developed in this circuit post-Garcetti. There is no support for the idea that there is a categorical distinction between job duties that are routine and ordinary and more general duties. In fact,
can you tell us, I'm really unclear on how this term employee business works in Illinois. She's a term employee with a term due to expire in sometime in 01, fall of 01.
Right, correct, Judge Evans.
Are people who are term employees just kind of by their nature more policymaking employees? And on the other hand, also, is what happens after the term? Are most of them just converted to civil service employees, or are they showing the door? You know, what happens?
I'm not sure I have a full understanding of those questions. I can file something with the court if what I know doesn't satisfy you. But I think Mr. Baker has accurately described how the system works. Mr. Gillo was hired in 1993, I believe, which would have been in the...
She's a lawyer. She works her way up to various responsible positions.
I believe that's right. I'm not sure how she got to be a term employee, but my understanding is that it's exempt from RUTAN. So... whoever, and I also understand that the departments under the governor's administration don't use this system anymore. I believe it was phased out later. So she would have been hired in as a SPSA in 93. Her first term came up for renewal in 97. She was at the Illinois State Police then, and she was transferred to the Department of Corrections in 99, I believe. And her term expired, as you indicated, in 2001.
This is a sort of follow-up, maybe. A long time gap between speech and a termination can defeat causation. But in this case, it seems as if the time gap is due to the nature of her job as a term position, and the reality is that it would be far easier to refuse to renew her term than to fire her. And isn't that the kind of question that is more properly placed before a jury? In other words, whether the time gap here would defeat causation.
There are cases that we've cited that say the time gap does defeat causation when it's much less than the time here. Here we had 18 months.
Right, but you have what I'm saying is that the time gap was due to the nature of her job.
Well, she could have been fired.
As a term, you know, it was a term position. It's
correct, Judge Roper. I'm sorry to interrupt you. She could have been fired for cause, as Mr. Baker indicated, at any time prior to the expiration of her term. Just because she's a term employee with a four-year term doesn't mean that's when she necessarily comes or goes. The corollary to the suggestion in the reply brief that you can never consider the time period because employers can, I think the term was wait in the weeds, is that every discharge that's done in the context of when someone is up for review or when someone's term is expired is automatically suspect because that is the time, I think, when the employer would consider a reappointment or a reassignment.
Well, no, look. In April 2000, she could only be terminated for cause. and she would have appeal rights that would not be present if her term was simply not renewed.
She retained other rights, though, of course, when she was not renewed in the fall of 2001, and that's why we're in this court, of course. She retained the right to allege a First Amendment violation. She also retained rights under the Illinois Whistleblower Act if she thought that she was terminated for an improper reason. So I'd like to talk a bit about the memo and the FBI.
Before you get to that, because there are a number of performance deficiencies that you claim that she had, give me an idea of the timing of those complaints and her ratings, her evaluations, prior to this FBI memo coming up. Put that in context for me. Well, you know, these complaints of other employees about her, and they're not attending a meeting or something, or she missed some training thing. You know, put that in a timing sequence as it relates to the FBI thing. Did this stuff occur before that? Give me some idea.
The record is not entirely clear.
I don't remember.
I may not be remembering standing here when she, for instance, didn't show up at a conference she was supposed to attend, or when she needed counseling by her supervisors to get her job assignments done on time, or when a log was created because she wasn't completing her assignments on time. There were weekly sessions that with Mr. Little and Mr. Small, which I think were called going through the woodshed because of their disappointment with her performance.
So were these pre-FBI or post?
I'm not entirely certain. I can look at that and get back to you with the file.
Because that's a pretty...
But there were problems. There were personality problems throughout the...
In terms of ratings, you don't have anything in terms of her ratings pre-FBI post?
Yes, she was reviewed twice, Judge Williams, that I'm aware of before the non-renewal. The first was, I believe, at the end of 2004, after she'd been there for approximately, I'm sorry, I have my dates wrong. It was within a year or so. And she consistently received acceptable ratings. But acceptable ratings there were four levels. Acceptable was one level from not performing at all up to the expectations of the employer. She did receive one unacceptable in personal relations. But there were complaints throughout her tenure, and I believe this goes to before the spring of 2000, that she was difficult to work with. And these just didn't just come, it's important to note, not from her supervisors, Little and Small. It was across the board from people that she worked with in the agency, from the head of the Department of Education to various people in procurement and legal. And Trujillo herself has admitted that her style and substance created personality conflicts across the division.
How can we say as a matter of law that the defendants didn't think she contacted the FBI when the FBI came the very day after Dankowski had a conversation with her about the criminal conduct and the documents that he possessed, that Missy, her name, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting her last name, noticed that she was awfully chummy with the agent, and they discovered that the agent who came was someone that she'd known since childhood. How can we then say, as a matter of law, that, the defendants don't think it was her who contacted the FBI?
It was conjecture and speculation because none of the defendants have ever said they were deposed. They never said, well, we knew that you did it. That's one reason why it's speculation and conjecture. It also can't survive summary judgment because in Mr. Baker's reply brief, he suggests that Trujillo just overheard Dankowski He actually approached her. He went to her cubicle. He sought her out and told her what had happened. And there were numerous people who had overheard this comment. So from the perspective of the defendants, if this got out in the office, that there were numerous people who had heard this, and not necessarily for the first time, then any of those people could have been the source of calling the FBI. As to the Judge Rovner, your point about the childhood friend, that was her response to, you're awfully chummy, but I don't believe that the individual who showed up at the at the department's offices later that day was the individual whom she called at the FBI. I believe that was random. So she just ran into somebody that she knew in professional circles. So there is a causation problem, and I think, you know, we read way too much into it to say that they knew, the defendants knew.
Well, sometimes when you hear hoofbeats, you have to think of a horse, not a zebra, right?
I'm not sure.
Okay. I mean, just, you know, it seems, go ahead. It's okay.
It's speculative. This court has rejected the routine distinction in the Sigsworth case and in the Vose case. And I want to turn to the FBI issue and just talk a little bit about why it was her job duty to make that phone call. First of all, Trujillo has conceded it was her duty. She made a judicial admission that it was her professional duty to call the FBI, and she admitted in her deposition that she had to call the FBI because of her duties as the chief procurement officer and to protect the state's coffers. And that's a reasonable view. That's a reasonable view of her duties because she had an interest as the chief procurement officer in ensuring that the department acted lawfully. And not only did she see herself as the guardian of that, but Mr. Dankowski purposefully chose to bring to her attention potential unlawful acts concerning the Combat Guard contract. It was also a reasonable belief to call the FBI because she viewed the ComGuard contract as arising from federal funds. So under Garcetti, that speech was not protected. Under Garcetti, the memo to the Attorney General and CMS arose from two different sources, her job duties, including the legal source, that the procurement statute. And it wasn't merely in her duty as a state employee. It was because she was the chief procurement officer.
So the district court is wrong on that issue.
District court, correct. I see that my time is up, Your Honors.
Do you have another minute that you need to finish some thought? I'll give you that.
I think I don't. Unless the panel has any questions, we would respectfully ask that you affirm the district court or in the alternative.
But not on that issue. Not on the FBI issue.
Not on the FBI, yeah. Not on the finding. But we ask that you affirm the judgment and in the alternative find that Donald Snyder is not personally liable. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Siegel. Okay, Mr. Baker, how much time have we got left? 3 minutes.
I'd like to address one of the closing comments Mr. Siegel made. He indicated that Ms. Trujillo made a judicial admission that she was speaking as an employee and not as a citizen when she went to the FBI. On page 10 of her reply brief, and I think we quote what she actually said in her deposition testimony. And what she said was that she felt she had a duty as a citizen, as a procurement officer, and as a lawyer. And in that same passage, she said, I didn't know if this was illegal or not because it had happened before my involvement. I don't believe that stands as a judicial admission of anything more than she felt for a variety of reasons she had an obligation to report this misconduct. Mr. Siegel was asked questions concerning Ms. Trujillo's performance of the department and if there was any propensity to be more critical of her performance after she went to the FBI. I will agree with him that the record is somewhat unclear on that point, with one exception. These Friday afternoon sessions that she talked about became more progressive as her employment passed with the department. They became more frequent, more intense. And these sessions were not about, gee, you didn't do this right or you didn't show up for work on time. They all related to her unwillingness or inability to kind of go with the flow concerning procurement practices and instead take issues external to the department. It's pretty clear.
And then those discussions that built up like that, were they post-FBI?
There may have been a couple before the FBI, but they became much more intense and much more frequent as her employment neared its end. I guess it's almost fitting for a closing argument to talk about her performance. You know, there are fact issues that can be raised either way. It's fairly clear that she didn't have a superior employment rating. I concede that. But her ratings were fully satisfactory. There's no evidence that at any time was there serious remediation. Was she ever put on any type of discipline plan? It seems to me the adequacy of her employment and whether that would have become a factor kind of falls into that healthy equation that the department would have to say, even if she engaged in protected speech, we would have terminated her anyway because of her performance, and that's the type of thing that juries are supposed to consider. If there are no further questions, I thank the court.
No further questions. Thank you. Thank you very much, one and all. And the case, of course, will be taken under advisement.